According to my exhaustive researches today, the Silurian period ended 443 million years ago. It lasted, however, for 26 million years, which is a pretty good long time by almost any standard. And so although I may have lost touch with the society, it goes on. And and now that I've been reintroduced to it and see that there are so many old friends here, I hope that you'll invite me to apply for a membership card. There's something about these clubs and associations. I realize that you are a society as opposed to an association or a club. But I don't know if you had read in the paper that my longtime colleague Molly Schaefer got into a certain amount of trouble recently as a member of the Century Club. They call themselves Centurions, or did. But that's sort of out of favor now, because Centurions are named after the Roman Centurions, all of whom were male. And now the Century Club has many distinguished female members. But the trouble came because it was suggested that the Century Club no longer have relations with the Garrick Club of London, because it doesn't allow females in. And what happened was that he wrote a letter suggesting that the people who wanted to break off relations for this minor reason were making a big mistake. There is a long history of problems with clubs like this, of that sort. Now, there was a club called the Anacreon Society in London around the turn of the century. I'm talking like 1801. This was a song and eating and drinking society named after the Greek god Anacreon, who was represented usually by the ideas of wine, women, and song. But something happened. There was a little dispute came up because some people wanted to bring in instruments, violins and flutes and lutes and that kind of thing to accompany the singing. And somebody said, "Oh, no, that's something else and it shouldn't be." And so the story goes, so some of the songsters there who would like to have accompaniment wrote a letter to Anacreon in heaven and asked if he would be their patron and advisor, and what was his opinion about this, because if they thought they knew him and that he wouldn't have any exception to it. And so one of the members wrote a poem, which became a fairly well-known poem. To Anacreon in heaven, where he sat in great glee, some gentlemen songsters addressed a petition that he, their advisor and patron, might be. And an answer came back from that jolly old Grecian: "Let the fiddle and lute no longer be mute. I'll be your advisor and patron to boot. And what's more, I'll advise you, like me, to intertwine the myrtle of Venus and Bacchus's vine." That poem was known, was turned into a song, which was known quite well in Britain and in the colonies. And here, it took on a special new life. That's why we brought the piano.
to this day, in this country, when anybody plays that tune, people stand up. I learned about stuff like that when I was in the Army. Not. What happened was, in 1955, I was about to be drafted into the Army. I had my physical. I was 1A and ready to go. But I was working at that time at the classical music radio station in Washington, D.C., WGMS. And I was not looking forward with any great glee to being in the Army, but you had no choice in those days. It was not a volunteer Army. And I had dinner with a friend of mine who was working for the other classical music station in Washington, WCFM. And his dinner relief came in wearing a blue uniform with epaulets and braid, and it was I thought maybe he was the doorman from across the street at the Mayflower Hotel. And he explained, no, this was an Army uniform. Army uniforms used to be blue, you may remember. And the fact that I learned that at West Point, the song was... He said, that's why I'm in uniform. And I said, what instrument do you play? And he said, I don't play any instrument. He said, I'm the announcer for the U.S. Army Band. And I said, no kidding. There's a job like that in the U.S. Army Band. They said, I'm getting out next month. So the next day, I was camped out at the office of the commanding officer of the United States Army Band, a man named Major Hugh Curry, who had been to B.C. Now, I had been to Fordham, so we both of us spoke Jesuit right away. I was also working for a classical music radio station, so I could pronounce Rimsky-Korsakov. And so, I got the job. And I spent the next 3 years in the Army Band, where I learned quite a lot, not so much about Rimsky-Korsakov, but I learned a great deal about John Philip Sousa. It was a terrific assignment for many, because I was working with a lot of musicians who showed me some things, some chord changes that you could use, and chord substitutes, and the importance of playing the right note, as I don't always do. But That was an important part of my life. But part of my job was to look at these patriotic songs and even to write some new ones. So John Cacavas and I wrote a song, which later became, believe it or not, a hit. The name of the song was Gallant Men. And it was recorded to great success by Senator Everett McKinley Dirksen of Illinois. It was a song that was originally written for band and chorus, so that part of the way through this march, which was a very slow, stately march, you could not you could march to it, but you couldn't dance to it very well, so it didn't stick around on the top of the charts for very long. Thank you. that record stopped selling for a very long time ago. The senator, who is quite a character, as you may remember, he has long since died, and with him the great popularity of the Young Men. There is a scene in the movie Easy Rider. Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda are riding into town on their Easy Rider bikes, and there is a parade going on. There are people marching down the street, and they're playing a song. They interrupt that parade, and that's how they get arrested, and that's how they get a public defender who's played by Jack Nicholson. So that we play this music played a key part in the movie. And now I get regular checks for like 11 cents. because somebody has noted that showed up somewhere in that movie. But it takes a long time to really get rich that way at 11 cents. So I don't regard that as one of the great things about my military experience. I learned a lot about the kinds of chords you use in patriotic song. And some of it, I've been able to take advantage of in different ways. Did you know, for example, that when Catherine Lee Bates wrote her poem, America the Beautiful, it was just a poem, and it had not yet been set to the tune that we all know. Oh, beautiful, spacious skies. Originally, it was sung to the tune of Auld Lang Syne. Oh, beautiful, poor, spacious skies. I want to point out that I live now in an apartment at the Osborne. And the guy who lives downstairs from me is Maury Yeston, who wrote the music for the musical Nine and won the Tony for the Titanic musical that was on Broadway. And he called me down to call my attention to the fact that there appeared to be water coming from my apartment causing a leak. I knew something about this kind of thing because Gene and I lived in an apartment on Riverside Drive, and Peter Max, the artist, lived upstairs, and he had an overrunning toilet, and it got a lot of water on the one wall of the living room of our apartment. I thought that he ought to pay for it for getting fixed, or at least come down and sign the mess. Give it some value, you know. But he didn't do that. But anyway, in the case of Maury Yeston, while I was there, I said, I'll have the guy, you know, come see if he can, what he can do about it, and I'm terribly sorry. And I said, by the way, do you have a minute? Because I had a song that I wanted to play for. I had done a music to go with the Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag. And he said, how did it go? So I sort of, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
While I was in the Army band, I was also working part-time under different names at WGMS. I was my actual last name is Charles Wood. I mean, my first name is Charles, my last name is Wood, my middle name is Osgood. But I didn't want to call myself on the air Charles Wood, because Major Curry would recognize right away that that was me, and I was actually on active duty in the Army. So I used variations. On WGMS, I was Carl Walden. Roughly means Charles Wood, I guess, in German. And then I was Chuck Forrest on WGMS. So what I bring to the table as an experience in the way of a journalist for CBS News is considerable, as you can see. When I was at Fordham, I did not ever take a course, not even one, in journalism, or in writing, or in anything of that sort. As Tony has told you, I majored in, I have a BS in economics. And one of the things that I have learned is very helpful in our business. A little BS will take you a long way. So anyway, that's... But another thing that happened to me, which I somehow even hesitate to tell us for fear that people will not believe it. One day, as a member of the Army Band, I went to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, because it was an anniversary of the Battle of Gettysburg. And you could either take the bus up with the rest of the troops, or you had an option of just driving there on your own. And another couple, and my wife and I drove up to Gettysburg, and we stopped and had a picnic on the way. I was not wearing my uniform at this time, but I was wearing the shoes that I was going to be wearing during the concert. It turned out the concert took place at the Dwight D. Eisenhower High School. It's not a huge auditorium and not a huge stage, but we managed to get everybody on the stage, all the members, all the instrumentalists, the brass, the woodwinds, the timpani, all the rest of that on the stage, and the chorus, risers in the back, and the chorus was there so they could sing Gallant Men. And unfortunately, my uniform was in fine shape, but the shoes, they were in terrible shape, but they were full of mud. And on the stage, in fact, maybe a little higher than this little platform, but not much. We learned that President Eisenhower and Mamie were going to be attending. And they sat right there. There was no podium. There was nothing of the sort. And they came, and the band played Hail to the Chief, and he sat down. He was, at that time, the President of the United States. And he had been the Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces in Europe. One of the most accomplished of all of our military teams. And there he sat, staring at my shoes. And I mean, he was clearly not happy to see that. But who knew that the President would be sitting there looking at my shoes? And I thought, well, he's probably not going to say anything about it. And then we were told at intermission in the concert that the President would be coming backstage. There was a photo up there and the press was all lined up to take these pictures. And I just knew what was going to happen. Dwight Eisenhower was going to slap me across the face. And the picture would be in every paper across the My disgrace would be total. And he did come backstage, and he did say a few words to us. He bowed, smiled that famous Eisenhower smile, and said nothing. I've always loved Eisenhower. No, he was too smart to make any kind of an issue of that. And later, he had an operation, iliitis, and was at Walter Reed. It was while he was there that we did what was a fairly routine job for the Army Band, and we played a concert out on the lawn. For some reason, the President decided to get up out of his bed and go to the window, and his picture was on the cover of every newspaper and magazine the next week. It showed us that the president was, well, at least able to stand up and to wave. But I think maybe one of the reasons he did that is because he recognized my voice. And maybe the reason he recognized my voice was that while he was recuperating in the hospital, it had been arranged by the owner and manager of WGMS to have me, for no money because it was TDY, to be broadcasting music into his hospital room. It was an audience of one. It was a broadcaster of one. And I was just playing. I had a list of music that he liked, and we played it. And when I finished, at the end of an 8-hour shift, I simply flipped a switch, which turned the music from the Harrington Hotel cafeteria downstairs into the president's suite. So he had been listening to me, and my fantasy is that day that he heard me coming from the lawn, he said, "This is too much. What is this? Who is this guy?" Anyway, I've been pretty lucky in a lot of ways, in the people that I've met, and in the opportunities that have come my way. I'll never forget Don Tucker, the guy who was getting out of the Army, who led me to the terrific job that I had in the service for 3 years. Oh, you had to sign into the regular Army, which meant you had to serve 3 years instead of two. But it was worth it. Believe me, it was worth it. Now, the only reason that I do verse in the broadcast that I do is because in most cases I can't think of anything else to do. And you can do some verse about something that's a particular pet peeve of yours that might sound a little too harsh if you were to say it in normal prose, but that is what we call poetic license. So I have a poetic license. In fact, I've got it in my wallet, the American Academy of Poetry. And every so often I'm required to pull that out. It doesn't do much good when you're stopped by a cop on the street, on the road, but it does wonders when people start throwing things at you at a poetry reading. Anyway, among those things that I have, that are pet peeves that I've written about, And they are genuinely pet peeves, is that people expect you, if you're doing news all the time, they're sick of hearing what's happened. You know, they want to know what's going to happen. How is this all going to turn out, do you think? And there is no answer to that. I can't predict the future any better than anybody else, but there is this thing that people try to do. And by the way, some of us try to do it too. This is engaging in what I call a gyromancy, which is the art of prophecy by spinning around into little circles until you fall down. But you hear examples of gyromancy all the time. And I must say that I tend to recognize it for what it is. Bullshit is what it is. Now here's a thing that I think holds up as an objection of mine that I've had for a long time, and that is that we have an obsession now with numbers. I mean, unless you can quantify it, unless you can count it, it doesn't count. And all kinds of decisions are being made these days just by the numbers. Look at poor Congress, what it's trying to do, wrestling with what will this budget produce in the next 10 years? I don't know. But they're all very sure about it, and they think that the other guy is dead wrong. But that's one of the best examples of, to my mind, of reducing everything to numbers. Businesses get started, or businesses get shut down. What happens when important decisions are made, when Congress does pass laws or change things, increase taxes or cut them or whatever they're doing, these have real consequences. And I think it's a mistake to do that. There is. I have a little poem to read you that I did on that very subject. And I have a little song, but it's not my song. But I think I'll read you my poem first, and then I'll show you what a genuine genius does with the same idea. See, because these days, so many things are being decided purely on the basis of what they like to call quantitative analysis, including even these days, you know, the market goes up and down. Sure, it does. It fluctuates, and every investor knows that. But these decisions that are being made are being based on automatic, computer-generated algorithms that recognize a certain thing having happened, and all of a sudden everybody sells, and one day the market goes to hell in a handbasket, and nobody knows why. And then 2 weeks later, they investigate and say, oh, yeah, that was some program because the algorithm clicked, and so everybody sold that day. I think that's damn dangerous. And the market, they recognize that they're going to have to do something about that, but they haven't done it yet. Now, computer studies have been done at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland and at the Ottoman Gulkin University in Japan to determine something that it seems to me is not quantitative at all, but they try to do it by the numbers, and that is the features and characteristics that make a human face beautiful, specifically a woman's face. Both the Caucasian and Japanese observers thought that average features look good, but like certain enhanced features, even better. A more attractive shape had higher cheekbones, a thinner jaw, larger eyes relative to the size of the face. The study says, along with shorter distances between the mouth and the chin. This seems to confirm something that had been determined at the University of Louisville a few years before, which concluded that the best eye width for a woman is 3/10 of the width of the face. The ideal chin length is 1/5 the height of the face. The visible eyeball should be 1/14 the height of the face. And the nose should be less than 5% of the area of the face, and the mouth should be 50% of the width of the face measured at mouth level. When that study came out, I felt that it was time for me to do a love poem to a few things. Cue the violin. My darling, whenever I look in your eyes, you transport me to some magic place. For the width of those lovely and wonderful eyes is 3/10 of the width of your face. When I gaze on those wondrous features I love, you can't know how much rapture I'm in. When I realize that 1/5 the height of that face is exactly the length of your chin. Those eyes, so hypnotic. They're like a narcotic, a window to infinite space. With a clout like a highball, your visible eyeball is 1/14 the height of your face. And your nose, I suppose, maybe shaped like a rose. What else could I ever compare you? Well, my tape measure shows that that cute little nose is but 5% of your facial area. You make my life complete with your kisses so sweet. You excite me, my love, like the devil. With your mouth, I'm content. For it's 50% of the width of your face at mouth level. This is a song by Frank Lesser. He wrote it for the movie Hans Christian Andersen. It was sung by Danny Kaye, who played the part of Hans Christian Andersen in that movie. And it's about how ridiculous it is to think that something beautiful can be measured and quantified.
Four and four are eight. Eight and eight are 16.